You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Trump's Secretary of Health and Republican leaders in the House released a plan last week that would replace the Affordable Care Act, but Congress is in recess this week and any possible legislation is on hold. There's general agreement, though, that some aspects of the ACA can be improved, but little over how it can or should be done, or whether the program should be scrapped entirely. If there's one area that might find some agreement on both sides of the aisle, it's bringing the cost of specialty services down. Most policy experts believe those procedures are overpriced. In her new book, Fixing Medical Prices, How Physicians Are Paid, Miriam J. Laugesen, Columbia University Associate Professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management, looks into how medical prices in the U.S. are set. It is published by Harvard University Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Professor Laugesen to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
The rising cost of health expenditures in the U.S. is having a negative impact on the American standard of living, particularly among middle-class Americans. You found that if health care costs stayed around the rate of inflation between 1999 and 2009, an average family would be about $545 richer each month.
That's correct. That's some colleagues of mine. And when I saw that statistic, I came across it and I was floored. I thought about this as, for the ordinary American, what this meant in terms of the money that in their pocket, and it really shocked me.
So have higher health costs canceled out any income gains we've made?
That seems to be the conclusion, especially amongst middle-income Americans. Obviously, there's a lot of news about inequality and the income distribution, and I think what that shows is that it disproportionately affects those in the middle income band.
Does geography play a role here, or are we paying more for health care in New York City than someone would in Casper, Wyoming?
Traditionally, there has been variation in premiums. So in the West, the premiums have tended to be lower. That kind of tracks things like how many HMOs people are enrolled in the market. There's a variety of factors that kind of lead to regional distribution or differences in health care costs.
Well, you are from New Zealand, but you've lived in California as well, taught at UCLA?
Yes.
So have you seen, well, New Zealand has a system similar to the British health system, or Britain has a system that's similar to the New Zealand system.
That's correct.
What are the big differences between California and New York?
I think there's a lot of similarities. I think the main difference is that HMOs really got started in California, so there's been more of an ethos of belonging to HMOs. Kaiser, of course, has a huge share of the market there. So that's a big factor that kind of changes the dynamic somewhat, and that's probably a historical thing.
Your interest in how doctors are paid dates back to your postdoctoral training days. What got you interested in this?
I think it was really the notion that physicians were sitting around a table setting the prices that they were going to be paid that struck me as truly remarkable.
Is the free market system at work in the United States in medicine?
It's not really a free market. That's the big misconception. It's really affected by a lot of different government policies, but as my book shows, a lot of it has to do with the power of interest groups in the medical system and their historical dominance over healthcare policy. That's how we got to where we are.
In the 1980s, didn't Congress believe that primary care doctors should be paid more than specialists?
Yes.
What happened? Well, what did they do?
Well, partly I think there was a lot of lobbying on behalf of specialties. They saw the threat of their income being decreased, and they fought back pretty hard. One of the things that I show in the book was that there was all these lofty goals in the 1980s to increase the reimbursements for primary care physicians. A lot of the same things that we're talking about now, unfortunately. And for some reason, well, I guess my book shows what that reason is. All those goals just have not been met.
Well, what role does Medicare play in all of this? Do private insurance companies take their cues from Medicare as on what a primary care physician should be paid?
Yes, most definitely. So the perception was, I think, when I first started studying this, was that this was a system whereby Medicare set some prices based on the input of specialties in primary care on, you know, what an individual procedure should be paid. And there was this perception that, of course, private insurers were negotiating and determining these prices with insurers. Over time, that Medicare system has been adopted by private insurers, and it doesn't track dollar for dollar, but what does happen is that when there's an increase in Medicare, that tends to be magnified in the private sector. Private sector does pay, private insurers do pay more than Medicare. So any price increase that happens in Medicare is actually going to be magnified.
Well, who determines what the prices in Medicare will be? Is there a committee that comes up with that?
Yes. So the committee that I studied is coordinated by the American Medical Association.
Wait, wouldn't that be a conflict of interest?
One would think. Now, traditionally, when you have interest groups involved in the policy process, it follows what's called the Federal Advisory Committee Act, which was designed to make sure that when there's interest groups involved in setting policy, that there's a set of rules around that, i.e. open meetings, a cross-section of people involved, those sort of things which are designed to protect and make the policy transparent. That is not what's going on here.
But you say the doctors know who is voting which way. It's just that the public doesn't know.
Yes. So there's a committee of specialty society representatives. And while they're not allowed to vote on their own particular procedures, what the interviewees suggest is that on this committee, there's a lot of horse trading. Mm.
You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Exactly. And it's also that, I mean, I think there was different views on whether there were voting blocks. But certainly, I think that this has introduced distortions into the system.
I'm speaking with Miriam J. Laugesen, Associate Professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Her book is called Fixing Medical Prices, How Physicians Are Paid, and it is published by Harvard University Press. Physicians Christine Sinsky and David Dugdale wrote a paper in 2013 about Medicare fees for colonoscopies and cataract extractions. What did they find?
That they were vastly overpaid relative to the time that it takes to perform those procedures. And I think that was one of the...
Is it because they're dangerous?
No.
They require all sorts of special skills?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that when these procedures first get priced at the very beginning, when the new technologies... There's this, you know, oh, this is very complicated, this new technology, you know, it's going to transform medical practice, but, you know, it's going to take us some time to get up to speed. And the problem is that nobody goes back and says 10 years later, okay, well, now you're doing it in 5 minutes. So what was kind of this really high-tech and unusual procedure, maybe performed only at academic medical centers, is now widely diffused. So let's reconsider that pricing. And so you get these distortions in the system whereby a primary care visit kind of stays the same over time, but you get these new technological procedures.
So when primary care physicians see this disparity, I'm sure they start screaming their heads off. Then what happens?
They have. I think that there's been certainly efforts on the part of family physicians to threaten, you know, to withdraw from this process, and if there's not more primary care representation. I think that those concerns were somewhat allayed, you know, by the AMA, but I think that in the long run, the underlying problem is the way that we think about these things, like what's a difficult procedure? What is involved in sitting down with somebody with multiple chronic conditions versus doing an endoscopy that might be quite straightforward? And the problem is that we've sort of tended to elevate certain kinds of medicine over others.
Is this why some primary care physicians won't take Medicare?
I think that that is definitely more of a problem amongst primary care physicians. But overall, the participation rate in Medicare is very high.
You wrote a paper that concluded that Medicare adopted this fee schedule proposed by the MA 90% of the time.
Yes.
That seems rather high.
It does seem rather high.
Is anyone analyzing or really questioning the fees proposed by the AMA?
Yes. I think that there's a variety of kind of external stakeholders that have been pushing for change for a long time. The problem is that the voices kind of on that side of the debate are not as noisy as the hundreds or the 120 specialty societies that every time there's some kind of threat to this system are able to mobilize and persuade Congress to leave it alone.
You write that the message of this book is that medicine has successfully advanced the idea that when it comes to payment policy, the doctor knows best.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's very difficult to for a layperson to understand. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of, I guess, expert, this reification of the expert and the fact that medicine is different from everything else. And not to downplay the technical aspects of medicine, obviously. But I think that there's room for patients, there's room for payers, there's room for more people in that room.
But we do know that some of these procedures are dangerous, and Joan Rivers died in an operating room, and I suspect she wasn't doing it with Medicare. She was probably paying top dollar.
Well, that's the thing. There's not necessarily a correlation between how much you pay and the quality of care you get. And I think that, I mean, I have a friend who does those procedures, and she was pretty horrified when Joan Rivers passed, because that particular procedure is overutilized.
Now, do we know how much procedures like colonoscopies and cataract surgery and some of these other things that we've been talking about, endoscopies, laparoscopies, how much they cost in the UK or in France or in Germany?
We did a study where we compared orthopedic surgery, and we found that the US was vastly overpriced relative to the fees paid in other countries. And I think that gave us a good sense that something is not right here, something is awry.
We'll take a little break and come back with more. We are talking about how prices are set when it comes to being our medical treatment. Fixing Medical Prices, How Physicians Are Paid, is published by Harvard University Press. And I'm speaking with its author, Miriam J. Laugesen, Columbia University Associate Professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management. Stay with us for more. We are back with Miriam J. Laugesen, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. She has written a book called Fixing Medical Prices, How Physicians Are Paid. It is published by Harvard University Press. And although you began, you were educated in California, I assume?
I did my postdoctoral training there at Rand, UCLA.
Was there a culture shock when you came to the United States from New Zealand and saw how different the medical systems were?
Definitely. I think that the long-standing kind of private financing in this system just exerts a whole different dynamic on everything. And I think that is a long-standing factor.
Well, how much of it grows out of Cold War policy? Because after the war, most of the European countries instituted universal health care. The United States didn't. If I remember correctly, President Eisenhower said that it would lead to creeping socialism. And so we debated it at the time and rejected it. And health policy has developed piecemeal ever since.
That's correct. I think that in the story of the evolution of America's healthcare system, I think one of the big missing pieces, though, is the medical profession and its vociferous opposition to change. And I think particularly the American Medical Association, I know there's doctors that don't share those views. The longstanding opposition and the sort of framing of healthcare.
But the AMA initially, I think, was opposed to the Affordable Care Act and now seems to be one of its defenders.
There's a lot of that happens once policies are put in place. Often people rush to defend them after having opposed them. And it's a very interesting dynamic.
What's the California relative value scale?
That was the kind of basis for what we have now, you know, invented in the 50s. To try and give doctors an idea of what to charge. It eventually went out of use because antitrust enforcers said this is not okay. And what that was the other fact that I found was that, you know, even though that was sort of outlawed, it kind of lived on as an informal fee schedule.
As I mentioned earlier, when European countries and countries around the world were developing their healthcare systems, we had a different approach. In 1948, you point out only 12% of the population had private health insurance. Did most people use hospitals to see doctors and get treated?
No. I mean, there was a lot less that could be done in those days. So there was a lot of office visits. It wasn't necessary that people went to the ER. People did have trouble affording medical care then.
We had a family doctor. We were poor, but we had a family doctor who came to our house when I got sick.
I think that's an amazing model, because think about treating somebody in your home. It's personal. It's compassionate.
When did private health insurance provided by employers begin to become the norm?
It was a quirk of the tax law. And like a lot of things in American public policy, we do through the tax code. So as health insurance became a tax-deductible expense and one that was not subject to government controls during the war, and in terms of compensation, it became a lot more popular over time and really sort of took off in the 60s.
In Europe, you found that one key method of keeping healthcare costs in check was to ensure that everyone has it, and that spreads risk evenly across the system.
That's the
basis of insurance, isn't it?
Exactly. And this is a fundamental problem that we have, is how do we get everybody participating and paying into the system? And it's not been a question that's been controversial in other countries.
The Paul Ryan plan involves people being able to set up their own savings accounts to pay for future medical problems. It's pointed out in the editorial in today's New York Times that not everyone will be able to put money aside.
I think there's a great misconception that healthcare is just like any other good. And economists have been saying for decades, it's not like everything else. We don't know when we're going to encounter a big healthcare expense. The amount of money that we can save for a medical expense is unlikely to match the cost of it.
Isn't one of the biggest stumbling blocks for Republicans who want to repeal Obamacare that the mandate is a way to spread the risk of those with pre-existing conditions and those who might be healthier?
It is a major stumbling block. It seems to be something that is being ignored or obfuscated. I think that there is a tendency to, you know, say we can take care of this by having sort of special programs for people with high-risk conditions.
How much of physician fees are being paid by the government?
Around 20% in Medicare is paid by the government. Overall, the total health expenditure of the United States, around 45 to 50% is publicly funded. So we actually have a really big government payer. That's something that people sometimes forget.
Well, there are two parts to Medicare. And one part is available to everyone, and the other part you have to opt into?
It's premiums through Part B. And then, of course, there's Part C and D, too. And Part D is the drugs. Part C is kind of a replacement for Part A and B in the sense that it's the HMO coverage.
And then where does Medicaid come into all of this? That's something that is different in every state?
That's correct. There are some general rules that are federal, but every state has a bit of discretion as to how they run their programs.
I'm speaking with Miriam J. Laugesen. Her book, Fixing Medical Prices, How Physicians Are Paid, is published by Harvard University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Where do insurance companies come into all of this? Have they tried to put downward pressure on the fee schedule submitted by the AMA to Medicare?
Not really. I think that we haven't given quite enough thought to the role of payers in participating in these kinds of processes.
Wouldn't it be in their best interest?
One would think that that would be a way of keeping premiums down. Of course, I think that what happens is that certain more high-profile hospital groups have more leverage in that sort of negotiating process. But the role of insurers in keeping healthcare costs down is fundamental and something that in other countries is taken for granted.
Well, not every doctor in countries that have universal health care joins in the system. Some of them just work privately. How are their fees set?
Generally speaking, there is uniformity in terms of belonging to or participating in the government scheme. What is possible in some systems is having a private clinic or...
In England, there are private doctors.
Yes, Harley Street. Mm-hmm. But that tends to be, even though it's sort of high profile, it's not a big part of the overall healthcare economy. Traditionally, it's only been, I think, 10% at most is private in Britain.
And usually that is reserved to people who have a lot of money and who want to have a private doctor.
Exactly.
Since 1945, you found that three processes of institutionalization have occurred in the United States medical fee payments policy. What are the three processes?
I think that it's political lobbying is a fundamental one. The AMA has been able to have a disproportionate influence on fees. There has been a lack of oversight, as you say, by the private insurers. And there's been a willingness, I think, of the public and politicians to sort of take doctor knows best and, you know, take that as faith.
Well, if a new procedure is developed, how are the fees set?
So there's a process by which it goes to the AMA first to have a code invented.
And that, for example, code, MRIs came along and suddenly you had to decide how much to charge for an MRI.
Yes. So they need to take into consideration in this process, how much time does it take? How much effort does it take? How much risk is there to the patient and therefore risk to the physician of you know, psychological stress, et cetera. So there's this complex kind of weighting, which is done numerically, but in the end comes down to a judgment call. And obviously, there's a lot of room for discretion in that judgment call.
Well, we're seeing that with pharmaceuticals, some pharmaceuticals that have been around for a very long time, and yet the prices keep on going up. Does the AMA determine when the fee-for-service needs to be updated as well?
A great thing under the Affordable Care Act was actually a tiny little clause which said we really need to do that and we need to go back and look and we need to sort of have some scrutiny. I'm doing some research on that to try and figure out what's happened and whether that policy has had any impact. My sense is that just like the regular process, though, there's a lot of room for gaming and also for hiding what you're doing.
We mentioned that committee that reviews the recommendations on fees and services from the AMA that works in secret except from the AMA. A two-thirds majority is required to add fees and services?
Or to increase. And so that's from an existing price. But the new prices, that's really where I think there's more discretion. And what our research showed was that the CMS, the Medicare agency, basically was more likely to listen to the AMA recommendations if it's a new service.
What happens when the AMA doesn't get the result that it wants? What does it do?
That's interesting. So sometimes there's actually a process by which they get to, the specialty side gets to go back to Medicare and say, hey, we don't agree with your decision. And I haven't looked at the numbers in detail, but my sense again is that there's a lot of discretion at that point to sort of say, okay, we'll have a second look. And in fact, there's often increases they go back on their decision.
A post-facilitation meeting, it's called. Within the AMA, aren't there factions that have formed specialty societies who advocate on behalf of their members on top of what the AMA does?
Yes. So there's a lot of opportunities for specialty societies to go around the bureaucracy and the AMA and talk directly to Congress. However, the fact that they're on this committee means that they have to behave in a sense and follow what the AMA is doing and sort of stay and keep in line with that.
Do we know, the AMA spends a lot of money on political lobbying.
Yes.
Do we know what they are lobbying for now in the big debate over whether to get rid of the Affordable Care Act?
There's always a delay and a lag in terms of that data being available about what they're lobbying on. But I should think that they will be lobbying to make changes to some of the payment reforms under the ACA that have the clause that I just mentioned to have that dialed back so that there's not quite so much scrutiny of older prices.
We've seen differences in different states. Some governors and state legislatures are very rigid about their feelings about the Affordable Care Act. They want to get rid of it completely. Others don't. Some wanted to allow for the increase in Medicare coverage. Others resisted that. So you have any sense of the future of all of this?
It's very complicated. I think that the real question is who's going to take the political heat? And I think that has been the strangely, because you'd think they would have anticipated the political sort of pushback. But in a sense, the Republicans, I think, have been surprised by all of a sudden people defending the ACA.
On the other hand, they did promise to get rid of it.
Exactly.
And Donald Trump ran on that platform. So should people be surprised that they're doing what they promised? That they're saying, you elected us to do this and now we're going to do it?
I don't think people are surprised. I think that they just didn't think through the consequences. I think people placed a lot of faith that if it was repealed, there'd be something else. But the question of what is that something else? And I think that, like in most countries, and I have to say this is across the world, people want everything at the same time. They want access to care. They want low-cost care. They want quality care. But they're not always willing to think about what are the trade-offs amongst those priorities.
I just went to Mexico for a brief vacation, and eye drops that I get through my insurance program, but cost me a pretty penny, were very inexpensive. I just went into a pharmacy, didn't have to hand in a prescription, and got these eye drops.
Of course, the pharmaceutical industry was saying, how do you know the safety and reliability of those drugs? But on the other hand,
is that why I'm going blind?
I'm not a doctor. But no, I think that, I mean, it's a real problem that, again, you know, we've allowed an industry to set the terms of the prices in that industry as well. And I think I'd really like to sort of apply this analysis to that industry as well.
Miriam J. Laugesen, Associate Professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Her book, Fixing Medical Prices, How Physicians Are Paid, is published by Harvard University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. Real pleasure. Thank you.